This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Washington isn't working. How many times have you heard that from Republicans and Democrats? Question is, has it ever worked? Is compromise a bygone idea or a total delusion? Have technology and history changed our society so much that we can't hear or respect each other's opinions? Duke professors of public policy David Chancer and Don Taylor think it's time to prepare the next generation for a colossal challenge of finding the key to gridlock and opening up democracy. David Chancer and Don Taylor are teaching a course called Gridlock, and we've invited them and two of their students, Kate Klimczak, who is a graduate student, and Chris Diaz, an undergrad. They're going to join us today, talk about moving gridlock and moving beyond gridlock in American politics. So welcome to all of you. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David, where did the idea for the class come from?
Well, Don and I got to meet each other in the summer of 2009, which was the kind of hot political summer of the death panels and the discussion of the Obamacare legislation. And he's a healthcare policy expert, and I'm a kind of old Capitol Hill hand. And he would come talk to me about what was going on in the Senate, and I would ask him about Medicare reimbursement rates. We got to be friends, and we got to talking about what was happening in that political debate. And here we were having a red-hot controversy, you know, rawest politics you could imagine. And we weren't really addressing the core problem facing healthcare, which is how do you reduce the spiraling healthcare costs that were really bankrupting the nation. So it got us to thinking about these broader issues about what is it about our politics that's kind of diverting us and preventing us from addressing these large scale challenges. And we seem to get diverted into other things that are not really all that consequential.
Is this just a function, though, of sort of being in the present moment? It's always been this way, right? People disagree, they argue, they hold their position, and then they fight it out in the public marketplace. Why is this really any different?
I think it's a fair point, and one of the things that we've tried to be careful about in the class is to make the point that our system really has been set up to make it hard to do things, hard to change. The status quo has been preferenced. I think what's really different is that the status quo of our country from a fiscal standpoint is unsustainable. So what we have now, if we do nothing, we're on autopilot for really bad fiscal problems for this country. So something really needs to change.
Kate, let me ask you as a student, from your perspective, you don't have decades of experience with the American public policy to go on. So what's your sense of how things work here? Is this pretty normal? This is how people debate. They hold to their position and they fight.
I mean, I think it is a natural sort of state of things. I mean, people do have
Thanks
opinions.
Thanks for the plug, by the way.
And they, you know, and they argue both sides. I think what's happening less and less, though, is that the two sides are actually coming together and saying, you know, I'm bringing A to the table, I'm bringing B to the table, and then we're going to find out how to get a little bit of A and B and put a bill forward. That just isn't happening as much for a number of reasons. But like Professor Taylor was saying, when you have such monumental challenges, it's really important to be able to find that common area and actually do something.
Chris, what's your sense of it, how things work? Do you see it as dysfunctional or just that the issues are so tough that things are really, that the debate is very hot?
Yeah, I agree with what Professor Taylor said, that something that is really important that's changed now is the unsustainability of the current path. So if you have a system that's set up to prevent laws from being passed or make it harder to pass laws, then that's fine. But then once you're in a position where the status quo isn't good anymore, that doesn't work. And then I think also too often when you get to a sort of crisis point where the two parties have to come together, too often where they end up compromising, or I don't know if you'd even really call it compromises, that Democrats agree to tax cuts and Republicans agree to more spending rather than actually being willing to touch the sacred cows, so to speak, of their parties.
So that's what you're getting at, David, and on both the idea that these compromises, Chris has just pointed out, we will cut taxes. Maybe the Republicans want to cut taxes. Maybe the Democrats want to spend more. We'll agree to let you do that, but you really have not addressed the issue. We can't go on like that.
No, we can't. Entitlement spending, essentially, on Medicare and Medicaid are the things that are spiraling. And over the next couple decades, we're talking about laying on trillions of dollars in debt. So, but you can't even really have a discussion. It quickly devolves to things like you're rationing health care, you're pulling the plug on grandma. That's where our politics devolves to. And of course, politicians, we can always blame it on the politicians. But in the end, they're responding to either cognitive dissonance in the voters, where they want to cut spending but they don't want any of the programs that they rely on to be reduced, or a misunderstanding of public issues. And it's to my mind, it's becoming part and a part of our political culture that is almost deeply ingrained and therefore very difficult to reverse.
Was it different? Was there a time when politicians, policymakers actually talked about the policy and not about these kind of tangential issues or done?
Well, I think even if you think of the last 50 years, even the Medicare program, which was primarily driven by the Democratic Party, there were some Republicans who ended up voting for it. There have been many, as vehemently as Republicans opposed Medicare in early days, now, you know, they're saying that we have to figure out how to save it. So I think there are examples. I think the Social Security reforms in the early, you know, 1980s that put the program on a sustainable path for another 30 or so years. So I think there have been some examples in the past of actually truly coming together and working towards some notion of the common good. It just does seem to be a sense in which things seem to be different now. And I think one of the things Dave and I are trying to do is try to encourage the students to try to think of solutions and not just constantly wallow in the problem.
Well, let's take a look at the structural issues that you talked about. David and Don, you both said something about the fact that the system is essentially conservative. That is to say, it favors the status quo, makes it hard to change. Is that always been the case, or have we been building in rules and structures that make it harder and harder to change?
I don't think it's that the system, I think ultimately it's a lot of the mores and the practices of our current modern politics that are changing that have made things get so ingrained. So, for example, filibusters have been around for a very long time, but they weren't an inherent part of the process, where sometimes you have to break a filibuster three or four times to get a bill through, or a filibuster is used on absolutely every piece of legislation, every nomination. So it's more about the way politics is practiced than necessarily reform or change in the system overall.
The problem is reflected in one of the texts you use called Disconnect, The Breakdown of Representation in American Politics by Morris Fiorina. Chris, what surprised you about that book?
I think there were... it's an interesting book. I think it brings up a lot of the issues that do sort of place some blame on the American people and not just our politicians, which I think rightly should be. I don't think our politicians, they do reflect a lot of the preferences and the behavior that we want from them. If the American people didn't want politicians that were arguing and fighting and things like that, theoretically they would vote them out and they would sort of vote in that sense.
Well, Kate, that raises an excellent question and one I want to put to Chris, which is, isn't this our fault? I mean, we can blame it on politicians who use, you know, phrases like death panels to distract us, but if we're that easily distracted, it's our fault. We're complicit in this and perhaps willfully ignorant. Something like that?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult situation because I hesitate to blame people when in reality, most people don't have the time to sit around and study these things like we do. And so to say that they don't have a right or that they have a responsibility to learn all the intricacies of something like the healthcare law, I just don't think that's realistic. And so I do think it comes down more to the politicians needing to have the patriotism or the sense of that they are public servants to not mislead people in ways that make it so that you have to really devote a lot of time to studying policy in order to make informed decisions.
David?
I mean, there are a lot of trends also that are kind of exacerbating this problem. For example, if you look at what I call media fragmentation, where we have so many new media sources where people are getting their information from, and all the studies show that people are gravitating towards media sources which reconfirm their view of the world, as opposed to getting challenged or presented with something that differs and maybe modifying their views, maybe perhaps bringing people more together, the diffuseness of the media is actually pulling people further and further apart, making compromise in the political system more difficult.
Yeah, but you know, this notion of objectivity is a relatively new idea. It's born with the telegraph, essentially. In the old days, the broadsides were very partisan, and people bought the papers they wanted to read. I mean, this isn't really anything new. People have always sought validation rather than information, don't you think, Don?
I think probably so. And I've also read where people have, you know, identified pamphlets of early 19th century politicians, and they were quite vicious. In one sense, though, I mean, this is our time, right? So when I think about these issues, I'm inherently interested in health policy, but I mean, I've got a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, and an 11-year-old child, and so I increasingly view this as. I think the country that we're in the process of leaving them isn't working as well as it might. So I think it's time for us to figure out a way to sort of make the country, you know, work for after something akin to the common good, even if we don't always understand what that might be.
Well, let's take an issue like healthcare, which is perceived to be far too complicated and out of control for any one of us mere mortals to try to understand. How do you tackle a problem like that? I mean, first of all, the myth that it's too hard, I mean, because it's not, quite honestly. It's an easy thing to figure out. You pay X amount for a certain amount of health care, and you either get it or you don't. You measure outcomes. It's not that hard. And yet the perception is, oh, man, this is just way out of my control. I'm not the guy to talk about this. Talk to somebody else. Where do you begin to get a handle on that?
Well, here I do think the culture, the 308 million version of us bears a lot of responsibility here, because I've given many talks about health reform, and it's very simple to whip any kind of crowd into a frenzy and for them to say things like control this out of control health care spending. But if I then start to talk about anything that might actually have a practical chance to do so, they say, oh no, that's not what we meant. And I think we're really profoundly delusional. We say that we want to control spending, but I don't believe we have the ability as a culture to essentially face up to the fact that everybody eventually dies, and that before that we have to figure out how we're going to make things work out. And that sounds very simplistic, but I do think the roots of the health reform difficulties especially are born out of our inability, our cultural fear and inability to face up to the fact that we all will one day die.
And Senator Alan Simpson of the Simpson-Bowles Commission came to speak to our class, and one of the main points he had was really encouraging us, the younger people, the students, to really get involved in these conversations about the debt, the deficit, and healthcare spending, because the older generation, the baby boom that's coming up, the AARP, they don't have everyone's interests at heart. They really do represent a small segment of the population. And so as we enter this conversation about healthcare, it's really important to have everybody's voice, particularly the younger generation, saying, you know, this is what we want. This is what we need. This is what's in our long-term interest.
But
Senator Simpson used a little bit more tart language. He told the young people in the class that they should get going because they were getting ripped off.
Yeah.
And made it very, very clear to them what the intergenerational stakes were.
But some voices are more effective than others, particularly and that usually is associated with money. Health insurance companies spent the most money and they got the most favorable bill by any account. They got what they wanted, more or less. So then how does money and corporate influence play a part in the discourse? Because, you know, a lot of the language really comes out of those ad campaigns that are very expensive, and a lot of psychologists and a lot of media specialists get paid a lot of money to figure out what language to use to get that bill.
A lot of our problems are flowing from the modern campaign, and the modern campaign is fueled by money. And money can come from corporate interests, but it also comes from activists, people who are energized and interested in politics. And the people who are most active and most willing to give money tend to come from the extremes of the parties, the people who, you know, really care. And that means that the candidates themselves have to cater to those extremes. And then when they go on to govern, the patterns and the promises that they made in the campaign move right into governance. And there is no division anymore between a time to govern and then a quick time to campaign, get reelected. It's a permanent campaign, and President Obama actually mentioned that in his State of the Union, and that is a profound difficulty.
So, Chris, when you hear things like that, what then do you do? What are the solutions to get people in the middle somehow mobilized and have their voice count as much as people at the edges?
Well, I think campaign finance reform is a good place to start. That's one of the things we're going to be looking into in our class, and I know some people for their projects looking at solutions are going to be really going into that in detail and looking in the aftermath of the Citizens United case, what can be done constitutionally to limit the impact of that. When you look at like the Adelsons essentially funding Newt Gingrich's entire presidential campaign, that's one couple who's responsible for the campaign of a quarter of the Republican presidential field right now. So I think that's something that can really take away the power from the polls.
Kate, what about you? What can be done? What would you suggest?
I think campaign finance reform is a good place to start. I think it'll also be important for for campaigns that can encourage young voters to get out there and get educated on the issue. Chris alluded earlier how it's difficult to be educated on all the issues and to be educated on all the candidates. And I know and I understand that. But I think, when groups like MTV and sort of I know some of the other youth groups that were mostly involved with the Obama campaign, try to get younger voters out. I think that's a positive thing because I think broadening the base of people who are voting is one way to sort of to take power away from the real extremes on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting seeing in the fall the AARP had an ad campaign where they had a bunch of older people marching together and sort of saying there are 53 million of us or some number and we vote, so don't mess with Medicare. Go tell Congress, don't mess with Medicare. And there's no similar organization that's advocating for the interests of younger people.
Is there an essential problem between the campaign, which is a kind of event, and then the ongoing process of legislation? You know, it's been said that Barack Obama ran as an independent but had to govern as a Democrat. And so the kind of support that he could get to put him in office goes away after Election Day. And the attention falls away. And now he's forced to govern, as you say, from the extremes and having to battle with that. Is there a kind of structural problem there, David?
Well, I think with every presidency has its unique things. I think President Obama was successful because he was able to portray himself as all things to many different people. So some people saw him as a second coming as FDR, and independents saw him as a pragmatist. And then when you get in, and not only do you have to govern, but you have to deal with a very fierce opposition. Some of the plans that you had to try to be a transformational figure really just couldn't happen. But, and then people get disaffected from the political system because what they thought they were getting out of the election hasn't come
but
forward.
The theory is with all those people behind you, why doesn't that overwhelm the opposition in the way that it overwhelmed the polls? And then you move to the next step, whether you're Republican or Democrat. Why can't you take that energy that got you elected into the public policy process and change the legislation?
Well, I mean, in one sense, perhaps the positive outcomes of the last few years are underrated. I mean, the Affordable Care Act actually did pass. It's imperfect, but it was what could pass. But it was a huge step forward. The various stimulus maybe was too small. It's very difficult to say what would have happened, without that. But I think that on balance, the evidence would suggest that, maybe we saved ourselves from a far worse economic outcomes. So I think there's been so much bitterness and rancor. It's easy actually to forget that, we did actually have some tremendous, electoral victories.
Part of the process is still working.
Yeah.
Don, thank you very much. David Chancer, Don Taylor, professors at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Kate Klimczak is a graduate student at Duke. Chris Diaz, an undergrad, and you can find out more at sanford.duke.edu. Coming up, how history shaped Haiti's future after the earthquake of 2010. Stay with us on the State of Things.